This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, and I'm joined this week by our co-host, Jonathan Bennett, when we talk with Liam Broza of LifeScope. That's coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 589, recorded Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. LifeScope. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Melissa. Like expired milk, 30% of your customers' data goes bad every year. That's money down the drain. Visit Melissa's developer portal for free access to data quality APIs, demos, and code samples. Freshen up your sour data today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Searles. Welcome to Floss Weekly. And my co-host this week is Jonathan Bennett. The great Jonathan Bennett, who knows way more than I do and is far more experienced on the show as well. So, Jonathan, and where are you right now? I can guess.
Hey Doc. I'm still here in the Flyover State of Oklahoma. I call it the corporate headquarters here at the home office. It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, thank you. And our guest today is Liam Broza, who's I don't even know how to characterize him because he's so active in gaming, in VR, in the virtual worlds, doing so much creative stuff. He's a contributor of code to a great many things, and it's just really great to have him here. And we'll bring him up after this message, which is that this show is brought to you by Melissa. Have you ever forgotten to check the date on a carton of milk? Like milk, your customer data goes bad. In fact, up to 30% of customer data goes bad every year. Melissa makes sure your data is accurate and current so you reach the right customers at the right time. Their tools have helped businesses maintain fresh data for over 35 years. You can add consumer demographic information to your records, such as property and mortgage data, even marital status and social media handles. Melissa helps you fill in the gaps by adding emails and phone numbers, and identifying current customers easily allows you to find prospective new customers through their prospect database. You verify your addresses, emails, phone numbers, and names in real time. Incorrect data entered by customers, simple human error, or duplicated records makes it easy for bad data to find its way into your system. Melissa can help you verify your data at the point of entry. You can also match and consolidate your records. Melissa's matching and deduplication tools help you uncover, merge, and purge hard-to-find duplicate records for an accurate 360-degree view of your customers. Their flexible deployment options offer different platforms to suit any preference, business, size, or budget. With flexible on-premise web service, secure FTP processing, and software as a service, that's SaaS, of course, delivery options, you can choose the best way to meet your unique business needs. Melissa continuously undergoes independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. They have the utmost dedication to your data's security by implementing strong controls and safeguards when processing your data. Over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. Trust Melissa to be your foundation for data-driven success. Melissa is supporting communities and qualifying essential workers during COVID-19 as well. See if your organization qualifies for 6 months of free service by applying online. So don't put up with sour customer data today. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log in, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. Okay, so welcome to Floss Weekly, and howdy, Liam Broza, who's our guest this week, along with me and Jonathan. There's Liam, who I howdy. Only discovered by reading that Liam is the second half of William. I didn't even notice that until I'd like known you for a long time. It's weird that way. So now, LifeScope is your. I'm trying to separate out all of the many things you do. I mean, if you, you're
sure. It's actually a much. It's a pretty easy story to tell.
Yeah.
So I fell in love with computers in my teens. Started in IT, then got into software, then spent my teens and early 20s doing computer engineering and hardware, learning hardware definition languages, trying to make microchips, trying to make print circuit boards. And hardware was so hard, I went back into software. And I really fell in love with a lot of the theory behind computer science and a lot of the ways languages are written, the way data is stored and mined at scale. And I got a job with a drop shipping company that was trying to scrape and index the net to like go through all these different retail sites and understand prices everywhere and how the internet e-commerce system was working, because nobody really knew in the late 2000s. We were doing stuff like that. Then I moved. I was in Baltimore at the time. Our company got picked up by a super large top five tech company. I left, went back to school, and then got a job at a defense contractor in Washington, D.C., and was told that I could do pretty much anything I wanted with databases and data. Got really, really deep into all of the best stuff that Microsoft was doing, all of their tech, doing certifications, going through everything. And I met a friend of mine, Steve, who was really into Java at the time and was, working on Java and these ideas of building free applications that would run everywhere. And then as they got bought by Oracle, he went with all of his knowledge into this defense space. And we became fast friends, started talking about data and the internet and how the way that software is created, the way that we actually search for information on the internet is totally broken, and the entire internet could act as a giant database if we could just build maps of the topography of the information, how it was structured, how you got at it, how you asked questions, how to this data set, how what the answers would look like. We built an entire consultancy and a couple products out of that. One of them was this data aggregator, data index called BitScoop. It was like this middle layer that turned all these different sources of information out on the web and on computer systems into one. And it made software development really easy because you only had like one major SDK. It's called BitScoop. And when we built BitScoop, we were deciding kind of what would be the most killer app you could build on these developer tools, because people wanted data science reports mainly out of it. They wanted to get a critical report to the CTO every day, and they needed to go through 1300, 1400 different software products that they had, and all the logs and all the files and databases inside of them to just generate a report faster, better, with more charts. We were looking, I've read a lot of computer history. Doc, we met next to the Computer Science Museum, and there's been a lot of ideas over the last 50 years of how would you build a personal information store? How would you build a personal knowledge store? Like electronic journal and life logging is interesting, but the real interesting thing would be, could the computer just make your biography for you and make it like a personal search index? So we started playing around with our general data aggregation technology and building an open source project that would just build a time series of everything you did, every place you went, everyone you interacted with, everything physical in the world you interacted with or owned, you know, like your stuff, everything digital in the world you created and consumed, and just making a giant timeline of that, an organized data graph that you search like Google, and it would have like instant search, you know, real-time text index. And we called that LifeScope, and we made that a free and open source project on top of our technology. And as we went to show it off, people have loved it and wanted to integrate with it and make it more and more open source and come closer to free data standards. One of the weird things that happened was I'm in Southern California. You know, it's the land of Snapchat. It's the land of Silicon Beach. A lot of people who are doing computer vision and augmented reality, virtual reality, like, you know, building for the Oculus Quest, which has four cameras, HD cameras that study your entire room in a 4D way, how you manage all this super sensitive data. Because we're all focused on like our chat history and our text messages, but the structural 3D information that you can get out of augmented reality, virtual reality, just photos and videos is insane. And it's a much harder privacy problem than I think most people understand. So we've been building some concepts around AR, VR, the spatial web, and privacy, and ways you can make software that's distributed, that's better, that's on better standards. And right now we're focused on actually virtual events. We've had a lot of people talk to us about doing virtual events on the web, doing them in 3D, doing them privately, all sorts of with security on open standards, all these different things. So we're a consultancy around information management in the digital age. But yeah, our two big projects right now are LifeScope and this virtual event platform we call XR3. That's essentially what I do with my life. I program 60 hours a week like a madman, building all this stuff with my team, and dumping it on GitHub with a MIT license. Yeah, and because we're really into doing projects and making magical things happen for people, and it's best to do that stuff collaboratively. I hope that's like a good introduction to what I do.
It's a perfect 30,000 foot view of what all is going on. You Doc had trouble trying to put this into words to start with, but what came to mind is you're kind of a modern Renaissance man, a digital Renaissance man. A whole bunch of things
sound
interesting, and you get to play with a lot of them. what you're doing, particularly with LifeScope, it reminds me very much of what Google did with the internet, you know, 20 years ago. They said, oh, there's all this information out there. What if there was a way to categorize it and be able to search it very rapidly? You guys are doing that with essentially people's personal data?
Yeah. So right now we have, if you go to LifeScope.io and you sign up, we make you a personal database up in the cloud, up on our Amazon fleet, using the open source tech that we have on our GitHub page. We just take that stuff, bundle it up, deploy it to Amazon, and manage this personal encrypted database for you. You can connect a bunch of services that we support, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Dropbox, Spotify, all these companies with APIs. That you can like social sign in on, like connect with Facebook, for instance, get access to your friends, your photos, all that stuff. And we'll make a copy of all of that, an index. And we're working to make it really easy to sync those rich media files and everything to different sources, along with some other open source attempts at this. We connect to all of your devices. So we make a Windows, Mac, iPhone, Android, native app that sits as a native daemon and just can log whatever you want, just like time trackers. You know, what files you open, what programs you're on, when the computer's on and off, where it is. Anything you want, you select LiveScope to record, it will record. And we have a browser extension, and you just go to a website, you know, like This Week in Tech, and I go and I tag it, track this page, track every major route, every major URL on this page, and tag either like specific URLs or the domain, like This Week in Tech would be podcast, Leo Laporte, doc, you know, tech. And now that's semantically tracked in your record of this is the tech stuff you like. This is the, you went to this tech website just by tagging it and recording it. And that's what you can do for any data. LiveScope does nothing out of the box. You can sign up and have it record nothing and just play around with our features. But where you can be like a crazy person like me and record absolutely everything I do. Everywhere I go, every website, every file, everything. And now my computer has a really good idea of, my LiveScope is a pretty good reflection of what I do, who I talk to, and has a lot of traces of my intent and is predictive of what I'm going to do next. And since the computer now knows that, it can be much more responsive and interrogative with me. And that's a lot of what we're doing right now is trying to make these like immersive, magical experiences where you can be, at times conversational with your digital devices. And at other times, it's just like a butler predicting what you're going to do next, helping you do it or suggesting something better to do. And being able to have this type of like really intense AI, this really intensely data-driven experience without breaking your privacy is kind of the magic. It's how you sell this to people. It's the reason why Alexa is super cool, but it kind of sucks because it doesn't really know you, and it's also not trustworthy because you don't control it. What if all of that was the opposite? What if you could have it all the ways you want?
So as you describe this, the term that comes to mind is a personal Wayback Machine. And I assume most of our audience is familiar with, you know, the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. You can punch in a URL and say, show me what this website looked like in, 2001 and have this, nostalgia trip. Or I often use it for, trying to find old data that people have erased for one reason or another. Just the other day, I was researching sysinternals, and there was a blog post on sysinternals from, way back in the day. I needed to be able to read for some research I was doing and turned to the Wayback Machine, was able to get it. So is this project kind of a personal Wayback Machine?
Yeah. So we, I can tell you two things about this. One is we built what we actually call the Time Machine. So if you go to livescope.io/XR, you can go to livescope.io and just look for the Time Machine. It's pretty apparent. We built this 3D web experience, which is essentially a steampunk style Google Earth Time Machine in web 3D and web XR that you and five friends can go in and you can actually make stories of your past. You can tag vacation Hawaii and tag all the photos, all the places you went, on our map. And then you get into this VR experience and you and five friends can fly to Hawaii, go right over the beach and see the photos you took and see, then I went, from the Starbucks to the beach over to this restaurant where I had dinner and back to the hotel. And you can just fly over those areas along while looking at all the websites you looked at on your phone, all the photo, messages and images you sent, along with everything you posted to Instagram, just as like this very immersive digital story, and you can curate that out. And now we're, we did one for the Magic Leap actually, won an award, a hackathon with the Magic Leap, building the same thing, a steampunk time machine, powered by this data. We kind of think of it as the sizzle and steak. Like we make something fancy and very cool to make the average person kind of really peek up and understand the potential of having all of your information in a place, in a singular place that's well organized and that you control. Like it could transform the software we make it much more personal, much more interesting, much more powerful. The other one that we did is when we actually kind of, we've built like three versions of LifeScope now. Really like between building the first and second version, we did this experiment, kind of user experiment, where we found people who hadn't seen the tech before, and we kind of asked them some questions about like, do you have a Garmin, you know, old school GPS from early late 2000s? Do you have an Android phone? Do you let it track your location? Do you have a ton of photos? And we'd find people with a ton of location data, and we'd white glove them in the LifeScope, help them make their own databases, connect all their data and get it in. And then we baked them an animation, and the animation was just them moving on a map. And it was like every day was about 3 seconds, a year was a few minutes. You could watch your entire digital life in like under 30 minutes. And people would sit there and watch them go around on the map. And they would be like, work, home, sleep, restaurant, work, home, sleep, restaurant, grandma's house, right? And people would watch it, and most of them kind of would freak out at points because they would see like, oh no, that's my ex-girlfriend, or oh no, that reminds me of a bad time of my life, or oh no, you know, that's my grandpa who died or something. You know, it's kind of crazy, the like sovereign introspection, look at the mirror capabilities of when people have to look back at their own objective reality, not their like Instagram reality. So it's crazy tool, and we've had to make it really kind of fun and feel like safe for people who use it. And it's still something we struggle with, and we're also struggling with helping people when they a lot of times realize that there's data out there, that, you know, photos out there, things they said out there, that they now want to delete now that they can actually find it. It's something we're trying to help with as well. It's really interesting to work in this type of personal data, 'cause you start to realize how all of our information is in these broken, fractured silos that are not necessarily easy for us to get at. Like a lot of things that we can pull out of the Facebook API when you connect with Facebook are pretty damn hard to find on Facebook, especially if they were like unpopular posts or negative things you said. Facebook has the data, but it's really hard to get some of that stuff off your timeline. It's crazy, the landscape of data privacy right now, as I'm sure I know everybody here on these shows talk about.
There's so many different directions we could go with this, and I know Doc is chomping at the bits to get back in and ask you some questions too. You mentioned something though, my ears perked up. People start their account and upload all this information to the cloud, and you know, there's an old saying that when we say the cloud, it's just a shorthand way of saying someone else's computer or someone else's server.
Indeed.
is it possible to run this service to get this kind of same results by setting an instance up on a local server so that someone can really control all of that?
Yeah. So essentially, we have been working on getting this this technology in a box so that people could run it on a cluster of probably two or three of the highest end Raspberry Pi 4s with 8 gigs of RAM and hook it up to a bunch of hard drives and it'll go. And we would essentially like where we're really interested is helping mature the technology, running a service and support company, like premium subscription, selling AI models or over the top like experiences, and apps on top of this, while keeping it open source. The reason we've been focused on the cloud is because honestly, the audience probably cares a lot more about privacy than most people. Most people just, they sign up because they find it cool. We do a lot to make sure even we can't get at that data. One of the things that's kept us from really being able to get the open source tech to run on your own server is we use Mongo Database and Lucene right now. They've been cutting us a really good deal with allowing us to make everybody a large, you know, gigabyte to terabyte sized text index of all their information, and giving us Lucene search indexes, which is if you guys ever do instant search on Google and you type in like cat and it's already suggesting answers and giving you results before you even hit enter, those are Lucene indexes. Those are fast text indexes. And to get that to work well for people and have like this kind of really good magical experience that they expect where they're typing and getting results really quickly, it's best that we use the cloud and all this caching tech that we have. We're working really hard to make the underlying storage tech better, where we can do this real-time search. And we actually have an alpha of it. I'm about to write a blog post all about it. And we're trying to make like really targeting Raspberry Pi images, ARM, and PC and Linux-based images that you can just flash on any device. But we don't have the biggest budget right now. If you guys want to help with that, it's all open source, and I'd love a pull request. You know, if anybody's a programmer out there, you know, we're working very hard on this. And it might take us about a year to get something really good and easy for everybody to just be able to flash on an old computer. But that's very much my dream.
So Liam, more than a couple of things, but one that occurs to me is because you're doing so many things, and the XR stuff, the background of LifeScope, could you take your history that you just gave us and turn that into a 3D XR thing that people could go to on your, that'd be great. I mean, just as a service to everybody's listening, because navigating back through your complicated life, and you're still a young guy, is pretty, and you're doing so much cool stuff that that I think it's gonna help people. Anyway, that's just an idea for you.
Let me tell you something real brief about that.
Sure, go for it.
So I have like a bunch of Google Docs that are these kind of fun, good to tell stories about myself that I want to make into kind of time machine experiences and then have them be pages on my website, liambroza.com. That's which is like everybody's personal website. My website's in a bunch of pieces, and my ambition outstrips my free time. And but that's very much what I want to do with LifeScope. And other people on our team have the same thing. I've made some private personal experiences. They're kind of rough. I'm not ready to show them yet, but my friends like them. Other people on the team have done it as well. And you can do it as well. If anybody, it's very easy to contact me if you want me to take you through and show you how to collect all your digital information and curate and tell stories with it. I can show you on LifeScope.
Put that in show notes. We need to do that.
I kind of want the time machine to be better. Like, I really need it to sound like the Millennium Falcon. I need like the weather to move and I need the sky to turn. And we're about like 6-7 months away from that. But you only get one first impression on this stuff. So I'm going to, when it's ready, I will be telling some stories in the time machine. Yeah. So,
About geeks is they, you know, they don't just need a first impression. They want to go to your repository and download, you know, what you're working on and patch it and the rest of it. That's a big part of this. I want to jump ahead because what you're saying, two things. One is when I was in your XR space last weekend, because you have parties in your virtual space, which is a lot of fun you know, create a little avatar and float around and so forth. But somebody was showing a screen that was emulating defragging a hard drive. And it just struck me as a metaphor that what you've got with your steampunk time machine is a way of defragging one's life. Because it occurs to me, my life is fragmented, right? You know, I mean, it really is a fragmented three-dimensional, not fully, you know, there's a poor directory structure for it, right? You know, and it's kind of like scattered on the floor, you know, for the most part. And the longer you've been around, the more stuff like that that's out there. So that's just a really great demo. Before we go too far into that, though, that would be a great digression along a path you're already on. I want to ask you about whether or not there's any synergy with or competition with what Tim Berners-Lee is trying to do with Solid. Because there's a similarity in a sense that you've got this pod, your life is in this pod. Have you looked at that at all, or is that a...
Yeah, no. So I've talked to Tim several times about LifeScope. I believe they're actually having a Solid World in a few days, where we're all publicly jumping on a Zoom and talking about all this. So what Tim has with Solid is a standard, is a membrane to essentially describe, if you had like a sovereign data store, how you would interact with it, how you would use it for a source of identity, how you put things in, how you take things out. It's definitely like a 1.0. Kind of to like put a little bit of history on this. These ideas of personal information managers, personal knowledge managers, have been around for a long time. In fact, like in the mainframe era, they were like way more popular, and they kind of died in the PC era for like many reasons. If you look back on it, I think Tim's stuff is an evolution of, I think, of four or five things that came before it that you can definitely reference, all kind of brought together. But thing that's interesting is it's got the most amount of momentum to go through like some major standards bodies and be like very broadly adopted by corporations, which would kind of own governments. I kind of started building LifeScope before him, and kind of independent to the side. In fact, I ashamedly did not really take a attention to Solid to like late 2016, early 2017, when it was pretty far in to development. And I realized like very quickly, it's kind of designed for like whole greenfield apps to be built on top of it, but it doesn't really have a strategy to get the existing information out there, like your whole history, into it. It also has a problem where it is yet to be tested at scale, where you're moving like gigabytes a second in and out of it. It doesn't really have like advanced search features. There's good stuff as well. There's very good things. What we're doing at LifeScope will probably be interoperable with Solid. We'll implement the Solid protocol, but to make our apps work and to do things like machine learning, we're going to have to add all these extra features to the tech. That's kind of how we compare to Solid. It's probably going to be like a Borging. And I've actually talked to the Solid team about possibly submitting some of the search functionality, the data storage and sync functionality to the open community. There's been other like politics in this space as well. Like one of the ones I talk about is the data transfer project, which is like this thing that the GDPR, the European Union, kind of forced on the big five tech companies to make their data interoperable and to make data exports better. But in my opinion, and most of the Solid community and free data community would agree, like all of the big tech actors are kind of bad. They're on one level or another kind of bad faith players in open data. They don't really want data export and data sync to be easy, and the ability for you to connect all this information across all of your different software, because it's a run for open source. It's a run to the cheapest data. It means that you can kind of mix and match features, and it breaks all the walled gardens. So it's weird that like the uh, or it's it's kind of rough for projects like ours because we have to fight to get access to information. I have to fight to get into an app store. I have to fight to get API access. I have to fight to make sure my browsers stay in the Chrome and Firefox store. And I have to fight if I want to scrape on a user's behalf, which has been proven to be legal, and I should be able to do, you know, I build tools that do that through browser extensions so I can get at my own Netflix history. I have to fight Netflix to change my scraper so I can get at my own, you know, information at netflix.com/history. So, the data transfer project is set out by Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter to make it easy for you to pick up all your tweets and put them on Facebook, but it doesn't work. You can barely do photos between like one or two services, you know, 3 years in. And the tech companies are like, we're really on this data privacy. We're going to be compliant with GDPR and CCPA and everything else. And they're moving at the speed of glaciers. They, you know, it's on us to really take back our information, you know. So Tim's got a component. I've got a component. Other people have great components. But it's going to take a lot more people interested in the problem, people wanting to use solutions, people funding solutions, using solutions like these data vaults, these data safes, these sovereign data pods. They go by a lot of names, knowledge stores, and that's not the way software works. Everybody talks a big game and then they're like, yeah, I'm going to do that. But then they eventually end up building proprietary data systems that have really crappy exports, if no exports at all, you know? So, welcome to the software business, you know? So,
yeah. Liam, it's interesting. You know, I've thought about this for a while too. And, you know, you look at all these big tech companies and they're free services. And there's another saying that goes, you know, something like, if you're using a service that's free, you're not the customer. and you think about it, and our data is basically the asset that these companies use, and they package it together into essentially a product that can then gets sold to advertisers, essentially. And thinking about that, I'm curious, with the projects that you're working on with LifeScope and XR, what does the business model there look like? What is the asset? What is the product? How do you guys actually make money to be able to support the development?
Well, we built the time machine about 2 years ago now. We started it, and it was like I had really had a fascination with data visualizations going back to college, and I love building charts and graphs and maps and stuff and learning how all that was done. And around 2010, you really started to be able to do 3D stuff on the web. And WebGL came out around 2014, 2015, as the Oculus Rift came out. People started playing around with 3D on the web to try to do VR on the web. And around 2017, it actually got pretty real. And you could officially do VR on the web. 2018, 2019 rolled around. Now you can do AR and VR at the same time. On the web, and we started to see things like Janus and other projects where you could actually build these social rooms. That's one of the things that gave us the idea for the time machine. I saw Google Earth VR in like 2017, and I went, oh my God, what if I could just put LifeScope data in this and make it like curatable into stories and make it social? Oh my God, look at this new web stuff. What if I could put it on the web? That would make it incredible. So we just started playing around with it in our free time, kind of as a hackathon. Inside the West LA tech community, it's a little famous. Like, people know about it. The videos have been passed around. It was popular. People gave it a lot of likes. And when COVID hit, a lot of people knew of me around here, and I got like 60, 70 phone calls, and my friends got the same asking, hey, can you do a virtual event? Can you do like a virtual product launch, some sort of like virtual screening? Because we love the whole 3D thing. We love the whole social thing. We tried it out. Essentially what we've been doing recently is what we call MyXR Social, these virtual 3D spaces like I took Doc to, based on some stuff that that's in the open source community, some stuff Mozilla did, some other stuff that Google did, and our own stuff, and mixing it together to make these social 3D worlds where we all come to a URL and it's a 3D space. We can walk around, listen to music, watch TV, play with 3D models, go surf the internet together. And in the age that everybody's locked in, this has become really cool. We've now talked to large companies that now want to do virtual conventions. They want to do virtual concerts. They want to do virtual product launches, virtual mixers, virtual sales calls, product demos, retail. We're working together to figure out how to actually do this at the quality and scale that is kind of needed to replace physical retail, actual business processes and things in businesses. And privacy has become a real big problem, along with a weird existential problem, which is the more ambitious people in this space want it to be a kind of a different web experience where, like, if, you know, say we're all shopping for, a table at our house, and we would all come together on our own, Apple glasses, AR headsets, and go to form a party between all of our web browsers and go to virtual eBay over here, virtual IKEA over there, virtual Amazon, and start swapping in and out coffee tables, comparing looks, prices, quality, kind of in a virtual space. Or doing the same thing with a professional workflow where we're trying to design a document or make a movie, and we all want to bring our workspaces together into a common place and mix that with resources that are on websites, such as software. And that requires you to have like a very robust sovereign browser that has a wallet, has crypto in it, that understands your contacts, your friends, you're holding your identity, holding all the sovereign information about your preferences, the objects you own, the data you have access to power the spatial website, to actually have all the integration you need to build like a really powerful immersive computing space. So all the stuff we did at LiveScope is kind of predicated to building this next type of 3D interface, immersive interface. If that makes sense, it's a little dense.
Sure. So that's a good overview of kind of the direction you guys want to go. But I'm curious, if you don't mind asking a very rubber meets the road sort of question, where does the money come from to be able to do this?
Money. I mean,
there's a lot of us that have really cool ideas we want to work on, but we have hashtag day jobs.
So right now we're building the very foundation of that. We are working on doing a big a couple big events in October that are going to be a virtual conference, virtual concert, a virtual esports tournament, and a virtual single player retail store. And we're working with a retail partner who is funding the esports tournament and the concert, and making those happen in social space on their website. And we're going to help build a really cool experience that drives users into this virtual store that connects them to an actual store where they can buy, e-commerce store where they can buy virtual, real products and virtual products and content. And we've been talking to a bunch of other companies going into the fall season, going into big product launches at CES next year, about building these virtual spaces for them, so people can experience virtual commerce, interaction with company leaders, and the 3D foundation that we're building of that is all going to be open source. And it's going to be built future forward for the software we're building. And as we kind of do these very basic projects over the next, into the summer, into the fall, into into Q1 of next year, in the winter, we're looking at doing even taking that money, taking some time, building this tech out even more, and going for more ambitious projects that we've talked to people in the long term, and really bridging life scope and what we're doing in 3D. And a lot of other stuff in human prediction that we did last year with some other clients, where we used a lot of what we've learned at LifeScope and done before, and what's really best in the industry to understand people's behavior a lot better. Once you have a lot of personal information that's clean, complete, and up to date, and highly accurate, you can predict. Look at somebody's past of where they went, who they talked to, what they did, and predict what they're going to do next, where they're going to go next, what they're going to say next, use that for suggestion, anomaly detection, all sorts of things. And we've done a lot of projects around that, really taking everything we learn and making it free to use for people. We're really a consultancy. We do projects for other people, we also spend a lot of our time kind of what we call in the bullpen, building principal technology and like LifeScope. And that's really what pays the bills, we weren't actually going to go do these virtual event platforms this year. Our plan was to raise a ton of money and for LifeScope and build all sorts of personal AI on top of the tech, Alexa killers, because with all this information, I can build a heat map of, like a hurricane track of where I'm going to go next. I can build a differential histogram of what I'm going to do next. I can build a chatbot that can give me 3 or 4 estimates of what I'm going to say next, allowing me to, automate myself, delegate, really accelerate my work with this personal AI that knows what I'm going to do and can help me do it faster, do it better. That was a lot of what we were going to raise money and do this year, but COVID kind of changed everything. It's a weird time to raise money. It didn't feel like the right time to build the AI we were building. We wanted to look at the crazy digital transformation that's happening right now in business, where everything's becoming virtual, insert ourselves into that, understand it, and then apply what we know about LifeScope to that problem. And we're doing that through a set of projects. Hope that answers it. Yeah. We have clients.
Yeah, I think you have clients. That's the short answer.
Yeah.
So there's kind of two threads here, and people in the chat room are going back and forth about this. Interestingly, that there's one, I think there's one line of thought that says that, we've seen virtual reality a couple of times in the past before. It's just going to be a flash in the pan. It's just making the web heavier, ideas like that. And thinking about that, I'm wondering, is COVID the killer app for virtual reality? Are kind of the virtual conferences and all of this, because we're all stuck at home, going to be the thing that makes it stick this time?
Well, I would step back and say what's really happening with XR and WebXR is that everything's becoming more immersive. I think virtual reality is an aspect of that. I would expect to see a lot more TVs and general devices with cameras and microphones attached to screens that'll allow me to have a much more immersive display as I move around. We're moving into light fields like Looking Glass and Leia. We're moving into AR displays powered by face tracking and computer vision that give perspective AR. Projection mapping is becoming consumerized, where you can have projectors, you know, big spherical projectors that turn every room, every surface in your room into a display that I imagine in the next 5 years you'll see as LEDs. AR glasses are coming. I have Magic Leaps. I have an Unreal. I have played with the HoloLens 2. You know, this, you know, optical technology is coming. Apple's got something. You know, Vuzix has stuff. Everybody has stuff out in the wild right now. I played with all of them. I think it's got a massive wave of AR is coming that is going to hit us just like the iPhone. It's coming very soon. And our AR glasses will be our VR glasses. They will either have blast shields that we clip on or magnet on, or they just can go dark like transition lenses and become VR glasses. And that's really what we're in for between now and 2030. That and like a world just powered by massive amounts of computer vision and machine learning. And like VR is a really great test bed of where that's going. It's an enclosed, totally controlled 3D 4D space, social space, in which you can build the tech for that world. And that's kind of why we're focused on it. The web is either going to get ready for that world or it's not. You know, if you don't like that web because it's getting too heavy, well, there's ways you can build it completely responsive. You know, there's ways you can extract out an RSS feed out of a social web XR space if you find if you don't want to burn through your phone's battery, you know, there, you know, or listen in like a walkie-talkie. In my opinion, like WebXR is about is really about an immersive, responsive, real-time web that's like the software we're using right now, Skype, you know, that's integrated into this experience and driving and accelerating this experience. And instead of me just staring at this screen right now I could take you on a tour. My house is covered in cameras and tracking and all sorts of AR gear. Like with the next few iterations of technology, we're going to see like an ability for me to walk around this house and take you on a tour of my photogrammetry captured space using virtual cameras that are cutting me through all the different cameras and zooming in. Like this is where stuff's going. I've been to projection mapped labs. I've been to caves. I've seen all this super advanced telecommunication tech. And it's going to be consumerized. It's going to be in the bezels of televisions. It's going to be built into security systems. It's going to be built into the, you know, Alexa and Facebook hardware that's coming. It's really about who's going to control that. And I'm trying to build an open source version of that. I don't think VR is going to get very cheap, very light. It's going to have much better focal planes, much better accommodation for people who need glasses and with different pupil distances and different head shapes very soon. Those problems are getting solved. So I think that there's going to be a much bigger general audience for VR very soon. I think the PlayStation VR is rocking it and really showing that it's here to stay, at least in some form. I've seen so much in enterprise training adoption too that makes me think it's going to take over training and large parts of experiential education. I hope that's a good answer.
Wow. It's good answers. And all of them raise too many questions for us to take in the time we have left. So I don't want to go too long into digression here because we're getting down to the end of the hour, but I've thought as a sports fan that I'm just amazed when the sports commissioners of the big leagues say, well, we can't have any fans here. When fans want to pay, and I'm wondering if what you've got is part of a solution that one of the bigs, because you don't have the scale to do it yet, an Apple or a Zoom or a Microsoft with Microsoft Teams, which is bragging about being able to bring 70,000 people together or something like that, of putting fans in virtual stands. Can this be done? Is this a thinkable thing? And I mean, because I would think that there's a lot of money.
So I have a theory on what's going on here.
Okay.
This will probably get me into trouble, but I don't care.
No,
there's a
not with us. Nobody else is here. It's okay. It's safe.
Yeah.
Who else on, buddy?
Yeah. So this company called NextVR that was bought by Disney, and they had a lot of really big VR contracts with all the major, major league sports, they're off the face of the planet right now. You know, they're just bought by Disney, and then poof, you know, their apps disappeared from the Oculus store. I think that Apple has something to do with it. I think that maybe Facebook as well has something to do with it, and that there are, you know, mega billion dollar forces at play, working on sports right now. Cause I think everybody saw that one really quickly. And I think that something really big is going to happen. And like the monopoly has already been decided like years before it came out.
And so, who is that monopoly? It's Disney plus Apple. Surely plus it was something
maybe
proprietary.
Maybe Facebook. Yeah.
And maybe
I think
Facebook.
They're all in cahoots to lock that stuff down.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I think that. I've been talking to a lot of people and showing them stuff, and they're like, oh, that's really cool, but we're doing something else. It's not as cool. So
Yeah. That's good. That's good. So that gives us a sense
That just leaves me absolutely everything else as a possible use of what I'm doing. So,
well, it's a gigantic space. I mean, I think if you're right, one of the things you've done a very good job of in answering Jonathan's question, I think is, and maybe I haven't looked at the back channel. He's been looking, but our chat room. That this is a for real thing. That it's a matter of time before we have the headgear, basically. That
I've already played with it. It's out there.
It starts obsolescing television as we knew it. That starts obsolescing the rectangles that we've been inhabiting for a long time. You know, what's the next thing that's not a rectangle? You know, because we live in a rectangular world. Our phones are rectangles. These things are rectangles. You know, most of the people consuming this, to speak of it, are actually listening. You know, so they have more dimensions in their heads. But go.
Yeah, I put on haptic gloves that let me feel things that aren't there and feel them hot or cold and rough and soft. I put on a Tesla suit that'll lock my arm up when I'm hitting a wall, and I've had one of the developers for it make me punch myself in the face because this thing was controlling my body and giving me hot, cold, and rumble haptic feedback when I'm getting shot in the virtual world. And it's got pants and shoes. I've been on omnidirectional treadmills that are like proactive and very much screw with your brain, and all sorts of other crazy tech. I've been hooked up to BCI machines while in VR. It's all coming, and it all, I can attest, it works.
You're the advanced team.
You don't have to look very hard to ask very many people to be able to try this now. It's pretty well proliferated. Like, it's wild. Yeah. It's
okay.
Coming.
So we have and we're actually very close to being at the end of this thing. We actually have final four questions we always ask. One is, and the first is, what haven't we asked that you'd like us to have asked that you can answer fairly quickly?
Pass. I think I just talked about what I wanted to talk about. Go on. Let's.
Great. The second is blockchain. Yes, that's sort of our control question. We ask everybody where they stand or what they're doing with blockchain.
What do I stand on blockchain? Creating verifiable distributed ledgers seems very useful. As far as a monetary policy, I don't know about that. I think that blockchain and Bitcoin and Ether and contracts have all opened up very interesting discussions about the decentralization, about encryption, about verifiable credentials, about distributed identifiers, about distributed verifiers. That's great. I am not sure anything that exists today or is being used in a major way is the final solution. I think that there's some ideas out there that might be right. DIDs are very interesting. Secure data vaults are very interesting. You know, I wish something like Ether and EOS worked the way they want it to work. It would be a great dream for them to be like a decentralized alternative to AWS. It'd be very interesting if there was a decentralized currency or way to move reputation or something, you know, as a monetization or trust, as a monetization or as a digitization of trust, or I keep saying monetization. But I don't know. Blockchain is very strange. The more I read about it, the more I'm perplexed.
That's good. Jonathan just wrote in the thing and thinks that Git may have been the first blockchain. I can see that, actually.
Yes. That, you know, I run my life on Git. So, laws written in Git sound like an interesting idea. I've heard that one before, you know.
I think the amazing thing to me about Git is that lightning struck twice for Linus Torvalds. I mean, first he invents the operating system we're all using. Then he invents this other thing that everybody's also using in order to write every code base there is. Pretty amazing.
Can we all be so lucky?
So, a final pair of questions. What's your favorite text editor and scripting language?
I have a weird hate-love relationship with Python, I use a lot of Markdown in VS Code nowadays, I hate to admit. Not the most open floss thing in the world, but yeah, that's what I'm doing all day long. I everything's in Markdown on my computer, from VS Code. So,
well, that's cool. So
I should say Vim, but just, I should have lied and just said Vim, but it's really VS Code. So would have got me a lot more credit in the comments, I'm sure.
So, okay, well, it has been absolutely awesome having you on the show, and we have to have you back. I say this to everybody, but I mean, you've uncorked so many topics and done it so well. I'm serious about like taking everything you said here or you just touched on and turn it into your space. And I hope Jonathan and others can experience your XR space too, because it's pretty cool. And something we didn't touch on is how deep you are with Mozilla on this thing. They're involved in this. And
well, you know, I bug them on their servers. I've talked to many people at Mozilla about this over the years. I very much try to ask them a ton of questions, get their blessing. We've been pull requesting code to them, submitting issues. It's become like a bit of a relationship. Same thing with, you know, I have to give a shout out to like the 3JS community, which has, you know, predates all of this. And, the Janus web community, which was the first people to do the VR on the web. And we went to all of them. There's also the Webiverse, there's all their other great, great groups, to build what we're building it's a huge collaboration. I'm just one touch of a whole network of people doing this.
I'm really curious to see how many of our listeners and viewers want to jump on to what you're doing and get involved.
Please help. Get on our Discord. Yeah. Find us. You know, tweet at me. I'll.
That's right. You're listening at Discord too. So it's all.
Yeah, we live on Discord. So we live on Discord and GitHub. That's pretty much how we're doing this. That's where we're all roads align.
I think we have more with you on show notes than anybody else we've ever had on. Well, thanks an awful lot, Liam, for being on here and on Floss Weekly. This has been a terrific.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you
for letting me talk. Yeah, this is great.
Thanks. So, Jonathan, deep breath. How'd you process all of that?
Liam is quite the bundle of energy. He's tough to keep up with. He's got two really interesting threads here that I think, and the way that he's woven them together is really interesting too. So he's got this idea of let's use machine learning and, you know, big database and all of these things to essentially let people manage their own data, create a timeline of their data, their personal experiences, their pictures, all of these things, put them together to have some sovereignty over your data and still get some of the same experiences that you can get with, you know, the different Google applications on the web and some of the Facebook things. That thread is extremely cool that they're doing it in open source. And then they've got this separate thread over on the other side that says, you know, virtual reality, augmented reality is the wave of the future. Let's really dive into that. Let's do it with open source tools, which is also really, really interesting. And then the fact that they're taking them and they're putting them together in these neat experiences, I think that's just amazing. And again, you know, we were kind of going back and forth in the chat room, in the back chat about, well, you know, the VR stuff, it's just making the web heavier. It's a flash in the pan, all of this. And yeah, that might be right. But the fact that we're able to do, the fact that somebody's out there putting these things together in an open source way, you know, whether it sticks around or not, it's really cool. And it's encouraging that, you know, this stuff is being developed in the open source world as well as just, you know, locked away proprietary in big companies. I think it's neat to see.
Yeah, I was very excited to have Liam on the show because, you know, I deal with a lot of startups, and a lot of them are trying to do this stuff I've been talking about for a long time, which is flattering and all that. And his is the first where I really get a sense of huge potential coming out of it, that he's really like, you know, like in comedy improv, you say yes and, right? And you never say no to anything. And he does that with like everything. Like there's a big pile of stuff. He's doing all this different stuff. And I actually have never been a big fan of VR, mostly because I just can't imagine clamping a thing on my head and walking around with it, you know? And I generally like new tech of all kinds, but it's like, okay, that's a little bit like, it's just too weird. You know, there's only so many things a person's willing to wear on their body. And glasses is going pretty far. I mean, I wear glasses for this just because I have these for this screen, but most of the time I don't wear glasses at all. And you know, the thought of having a thing on my head, but he sold me to some, you know, even more than he usually does with this today. I think there's and I think he's right that, I mean, Apple has been curiously silent on this, and they really need the next big thing. I mean, they really do. And I hate to see something fully proprietary come out, or that Google has one and Apple/Facebook have the other. You know, like there are four captains of technology that are going to be speaking to Congress today, probably are speaking right now, you know, and they're looking to break those up or something like that. And I'm thinking, you guys have no idea what's coming next. You know, that's the thing you should be worried about or putting your faith in. They're, you know, they're, and it's probably not even going to come from the biggest, coolest things may not even come from them. They come from the Liams of the world. You know, I mean, Liam today is what Tim Berners-Lee was 30 years ago. And there are others like him. But what I like about what he's doing is that he comes from the floss world. He comes from the let's all be sovereign world rather than the how can I control the universe world. And that's different. He doesn't want to build an evil empire. He just wants to do good in some fun ways. So what have you got to plug? Because we're gonna
sure. So I'll mention my weekly security article over at Hackaday.com. It runs every Friday morning. You guys can check it out. I do kind of a roundup of what's going on for the week, and I think we've actually got a story that we're going to break. As far as I know, nobody else has covered this yet. A data breach somewhere, maybe a company you haven't heard of, but we're going to be taking a look at that this Friday. That one may run a little earlier. I'm not sure yet. But anyway, keep an eye out for my work over on Hackaday.
That's cool. My only plug is customer comments again. Watch that space. There's nothing showing up too much on it right now. If you look at my blog, I have I've been doing something that has had very little response, but those who have listened to it, I've been trying audio blogging, just like I'm going to put on my blog. That's just if you go to doc.searles.com, that's the short link to something that's much longer at Harvard, which is host the thing, that are just some thoughts about where we're going and what's going on. So that's my little plug. So I want to also plug next week. We have coming in. I have to click on the thing here to make sure I get the right one. But coming, it was Wes Turner for the Rensselaer Center for Open Source. And they're doing some really cool things in the academic world around open source. So looking forward to that next week. So thanks a lot, Jonathan, and thanks a lot, Liam, and thanks a lot for tuning into another Floss Weekly.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android. Each week, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ron Richards and Florence Ion, as well as a whole rotating cast of guests, journalists in the Android space, experts, developers, and even people working on Android behind the scenes at Google. We talk about everything that has to do with Android, and you don't want to miss a single episode so you know what's going on behind the scenes. That's twit.tv/AAA. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode.